I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Today on the show, money. Our guest is Jacob Goldstein, the co-host of NPR's Planet Money that airs Saturdays at noon on WHYY and the author of a new book, Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. We spoke recently at an online audience event. While money is a source of much confusion, heartache, conflict, and misery, Goldstein says it's really a shared fiction, more about intangibles like trust and faith than hard, cold cash. Reading his book got me thinking about many things, including billionaires. And according to the Institute for Policy Studies, last year, three men, Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, held more wealth than the bottom 50% of the U.S. population. With that in mind, I pulled a $10 bill out of my wallet and asked Jacob Goldstein what it was worth. Jacob Goldstein, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. I pulled this out of my wallet. It's a $10 bill because reading your book, all of a sudden I felt like I don't know what this is anymore. What is money?
I mean, it's what we use to buy stuff.
Yeah.
It's this thing people made up and have continued to make up in different ways to suit different needs and solve different problems.
And it's something that we agree. I mean, I've got this $10 bill, and for me, it's a $10 bill. For you, it's a $10 bill. For our listeners, our audience, it's a $10 bill. So it's something that we have agreed is a $10 bill.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, the move you just made of like pulling out the $10 bill and saying, why is it worth anything? It's actually a move that Franklin Roosevelt made with his advisors in 1933, basically, when he was about to take the country off the gold standard. And they were all freaking out, you know, as the sort of conventional wisdom at the time was that to go off the gold standard, in the words of one of Roosevelt's advisors, would be the end of Western civilization, because everybody had this idea that, you know, the only way you could do money would be to be on the gold standard. And he pulls a $10 bill out of his wallet, or maybe it was a 20, but he pulls a bill out of his wallet. And he says, why is this worth anything? Just because we agree it is. And his idea was we can do anything we want for money. We're making it up.
Well, in fact, that's what your book is about. And let's put a little bit of history on the table so that we can talk about current day issues. You say that money didn't really come from bartering. It was from something you described as a double coincidence of wants. What does that mean?
So the double coincidence of wants is barter. So barter is basically if you happen to have a thing that I want and I happen to have a thing you want, that's what economists have in a sort of gratuitously complex way called the double coincidence of wants. And the sort of traditional idea of where money came from was that it came from barter, and barter is inconvenient because if you don't have what I want, and I don't have what you want, we can't make an exchange. But what, in fact, anthropologists have figured out is that's not really true. Money doesn't really come from barter. And the barter story is this very kind of cold, atomistic, sort of market-based story of what money is. And that sort of makes sense. It's rational, and it feels like money is this kind of cold, atomistic thing. But in fact, you know, what the anthropologists have figured out, have told us, is money actually comes from something much more social, much more kind of warm and fuzzy-ish. You know, it comes out of small, non-industrial, you know, sort of tribal societies where people have these very set norms of giving and getting and reciprocity. And there are rules, for example, if you're going to marry someone, what do you have to give their family? You know, often it's something like cattle. Or if you kill someone, what do you have to give their family? And those rules, which are more like norms that are kind of collectively established, those are really the roots of money. And I find that useful to think about because it takes money out of this very like cold, impersonal, almost like physics-y world, and into this much more kind of messy, human, warm, fuzzy world, which is interesting and useful, I think, in thinking about money.
Sure, and it's the world we live in. So why did the Greeks invent coins?
So the Greeks loved coins. They took them from the Lydians, their neighbors in present-day Turkey. And the initial invention of coins was actually because the Lydians, this kingdom in what's now Turkey, they had a lot of this metal called electrum. Electrum is a mix of gold and silver. And in the world at the time, you know, this was like Eastern Mediterranean, a few hundred years BC, 600 years BC-ish, silver and gold were money. But if you have a mix of silver and gold, it's like, well, then you have to assay it, and that's inconvenient for trade. So what the Lydians did was they took electrum, this gold-silver mix that was sort of a set ratio, and they started stamping it into lumps of like a fixed weight, and then putting the royal seal, which was a lion, on top of it. And so that was like a guarantee that it was a fixed weight of this metal and a fixed ratio of gold and silver, and that was a coin. And then everybody liked it, so they made gold ones and they made silver ones, and the Greeks really went crazy for coins. That was the first place, at least in the West, that coins proliferated, because the Greeks had this new kind of civilization, really, right? It was neither the sort of traditional, you know, reciprocity, let's all have norms about giving and getting. It was too big for that. It was also not like the big civilizations in the Middle East had been, very like top down. There were civilizations that were much bigger and more complex, where there was like a priest or a king or a queen who would sort of make the rules and decide who got what. So you don't really need money in that kind of society either. What the Greeks had was something in the middle, a society that was too big and complex for like warm, fuzzy reciprocity, but also too egalitarian, though not really egalitarian by our standards today, but for the time egalitarian, too egalitarian to be top down. So they invented, you know, money, coins specifically, to navigate this world.
And of course, if you have a lot of coins, that's a lot of coinage to drag around. So
yes,
that leads us, of course, to paper money, which we have to credit the Chinese for that. But you tell a really fascinating story about Kublai Khan, who had his own money, but instead of being based on, I don't know, sheep or grain or something like that, it was based on nothing. It was based on Kublai Khan.
Yeah, so the Chinese started using paper money around 1000 AD, before Kublai Khan and the Mongols came. And they actually started in this part of China where they used iron coins for money. And because the value of the money was based on how much the metal was worth, and iron wasn't worth very much, it was like terrible money, right? You needed a pound and a half of iron coins to buy a pound of salt. It'd be like, you know, shopping with pennies or something. So some merchant in Sichuan has this idea, well, give me your terrible iron coins, and I'll give you like a receipt, like a claim check, a coat check. And so people started using the receipts as paper money. So that's like paper money, you know, 1.0 or whatever. And it spreads through China. And then the Mongols come riding in and conquer China a couple hundred years later. And Kublai Khan is a very powerful ruler. And the Mongols are, you know, nomadic people, and they have this very vast empire. So, of course, the value of paper money is great to them. Like, they recognize that this is a really useful technology. And in fact, paper money was part of this great like flowering of the Chinese economy and of technology. It was this whole sort of market-based transformation that went along with it. And Kublai Khan pushed it even farther. You know, to that point, paper money had been like a claim check, originally for iron coins, then for bronze coins and silver in some instances. And he eventually is like, you know what? It's just paper, which is wild, right? Like Marco Polo happens to go to China at this point, and he, you know, comes back and writes his famous book. And people literally don't believe him when they says, you know, the great Khan causeth the bark of trees to be used as money throughout his dominions. But it was true, right? And it worked for a while. But, you know, there is this historical problem when you can just print money, which is you want to print too much of it. And Kublai Khan kept trying to invade Japan, and he printed too much money, and there was a lot of inflation. And then there was a sort of a revolution, and they kicked the Mongols out. And the next Chinese emperor had these very kind of idealized notions of the past. He was like against money, basically against markets, and wanted to go back to this sort of idealized agrarian world. And the Chinese basically got rid of paper money. They invented it hundreds of years before it appeared in Europe. And they're like, you know what? We're just not going to do that. And after they got rid of paper money, they got poorer. Like their economy got worse off. They went backwards.
But I was thinking about Kublai Khan, sort of basically having money that was based on nothing. Is that sort of like what it is today, that we've got money, it gets transacted all over the world, and yet we don't really know what's behind all this money?
Yes, money today is absolutely based on nothing.
On nothing, okay.
On nothing at all. I mean, Or you could say, you know, when we're using dollars, what it's really based on is trust in our society, right? Like, what is really behind the dollar, it's not gold. You can't trade it in for any fixed thing. But what we're trusting in when we use dollars, when we keep our money in dollars, is that the U.S. will persist as a going concern, right? That's really what's behind money today, is the government, the society.
And we have to believe that we are good for it, correct?
Yes, although, I mean, good for it is an interesting word because, like, there's nothing to be good for on a certain level. Like, you can't trade in a dollar for anything. What we have to believe is that the country is going to keep functioning, that the economy is going to keep functioning, right? That the government is going to keep functioning. That's really what money is based on now.
You have a really, it's hilarious, fascinating, scary, confounding chapter about America in the 19th century and the fact that people could just print their own money. And they did. And I'm not going to do justice to this wonderful passage that you include, but this is a traveler who talks about Kentucky money and money of Northwestern Bank of Virginia and money associated with some kind of Philadelphia bank or Pennsylvania bank, money affiliated with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. And the problem he had was trying to spend that money, which would get rejected because we only accept this money. We don't accept that money. What a crazy system.
Yeah, it's really a wild moment in the history of money. It was called free banking. And, you know, there was this great debate in America from the founding, from, you know, Hamilton versus Jefferson and Madison in 1789, 1790, all the way through the early 1900s when we finally created the Fed, over truly who gets to print money in America. Can the federal government do it? Can states do it? Is it private banks? Is it, you know, some kind of public central bank? And at this time, which was like 1840s, 50s, it was a period called free banking, when we had decided, for one thing, the federal government has no business printing money. There was no government-printed paper money. So it was up to the states. And the states decided that anyone who wanted to start a bank could, provided that they followed some simple rules. And so... lots of people, turns out, if you say you can print money, lots of people want to print money. So lots of banks sprung up and banks printed their own paper money. And there were literally thousands of kinds of money. And one really interesting detail to me of this time is, you know, there's this obvious problem of, like, what do you even do if you're running a store and somebody comes in
exactly.
and gives you a piece of paper? And they're like, no, this is really $3. And you're like, right. It's just some random piece of paper with a cow on it. And so there arose these publications that were like magazines, kind of like phone books, for those of us old enough to remember phone books, they were called banknote reporters, and they listed essentially every bank and the money they printed and what it looked like. And also, interestingly, they told the merchant how to value the money, right? Because in this world, we're still in a world where gold and silver are like the fundamental money thing. And paper money is still a claim check, like it was, you know, in China in the year 1000 before Kublai Khan showed up. And so if the bank is not good, if the bank is going to go out of business, maybe you won't get your gold and silver back, right? Or even if the bank is far away, if you're in New York and the bank is in whatever, Ohio, that's going to be harder to get the money back there. So this book not only tells you what it looks like, it also says, you know, take it at face value, or like, bank's a little sketchy, just, you know, knock 10% off the value.
More from Jacob Goldstein after this very short break. He's the co-host of NPR's Planet Money, author of a new book, Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen. Let's get back to my conversation with Planet Money's Jacob Goldstein, author of Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. We left off talking about the problems of free banking in 19th century America when almost anyone could create their own currency. I mean, one can see why there was then a call for some kind of currency that we all could agree on in this country that a dollar is a dollar and, you know, $10 is a $10 note.
Yeah. I mean, interestingly, it was the Civil War was what really ended this era. As with so many other things, it was this moment when, you know, this pendulum from the states to the federal government swung back to the federal government. And during the Civil War, the federal government passed a series of banking laws that, for one thing, created national banks, which had not existed, and made stricter rules for them. And those banks printed paper money and also basically taxed all those state banknotes out of existence. So, you know, there is this idea that the Civil War is when, you know, people went from saying the United States are to the United States is, which is like quasi-apocryphal, but like true-ish. And certainly that happened with money, right? And there is this idea that money is kind of what makes a country a country.
Picking up on this idea that there were that anyone could be a banker, Ron asks, if money is fiction, what can be said of cryptocurrency or things like Bitcoin? And we're talking about the 1840s and 50s. Was that kind of the Bitcoin of that era?
I mean, that's an interesting comparison. You know, one of the things about Bitcoin, like I will say, I don't think people are really using Bitcoin as money now. I mean, there is the simple thing of just like, can you use it to buy stuff? Not really. Like, you know, you pay a ransom, right? If you're like some business and you get hacked, you pay a ransom in Bitcoin. But it could work as money. And it would be a private money, right? We live in a world of basically all public monies. But I do think the comparison between Bitcoin and these monies of the 1840s and 50s is interesting. And the fundamental thing that I think connects them is they're privately created. And that seems right. So strange to us because we live in this world of, you know, where money is public, money is the government. And it doesn't have to be so. It has often been so. It has usually been so, but it doesn't have to be.
But it also underscores this idea that it's something you have to have trust in, you have to believe in. It's a kind of a shared experience. And I think people involved in Bitcoin feel that way. We once did a show about Bitcoin, and an hour later, I had no idea what Bitcoin was.
It could work as money if everybody decided to use it. I mean, there are some technical things, like it can't actually process that many transactions or whatever, but those are solvable, right? The big shift, I feel like, with Bitcoin is not so much technical. There's interesting technical things in it. It's more the shift from public to private. And in fact, you know, what's most interesting to me in the storytelling in the book is this sort of prehistory of Bitcoin is these basically techno-libertarians in Silicon Valley who are dreaming that these technical problems can create this sort of online stateless paradise that runs on this, you know, stateless money.
Well, let's make a leap to the Federal Reserve. I guess you can't get more stateful than that in a certain kind of way. But you do call it, you know, and clearly it is one of the most powerful institutions, not just in this country, but certainly in the world. And its creation was designed to solve what problem?
Well, so the U.S. didn't have a central bank from 1836 until, I think, 1913, whatever that is. One of the problems was there were financial crises that were very frequent. You know, like if you think of the crisis of 2008, there was one of those like every 10 or so years. And by this point, most European countries had central banks, and they had figured out that there's just this basic problem with finance, which is it is subject to runs, to bank runs, right? Every once in a while, people get nervous. Everybody rushes to the bank to pull their money out. There was no deposit insurance at that time. Governments didn't stand behind people's bank accounts like they do now. And what people had realized in the 19th century was a central bank can make those that much better, can't quite get rid of them, but can reduce the problems of financial crises a lot by basically being willing to lend to banks in a panic. So you have banks that are basically fine, sound, honest banks, but if everybody goes and wants their money at the same time, right, the best bank in the world is going to collapse. The U.S. didn't have a central bank, in part because of what we were discussing earlier. There was this long argument in America over should we have a central bank? Should the federal government be in the business of money at all? Would it represent a dangerous concentration of power? And it was so extreme, this fear, that even after there was this terrible financial panic in 1907, even after it had to be solved by basically the richest banker in America, J.P. Morgan, who corralled all the bankers in New York and more or less locked them in his library and said, solve this panic. Even after all that, people weren't like, okay, we need a central bank. What had to happen was there was a senator who thought we needed a central bank, and some bankers, one of whom was from Europe, who was like, why do you even do money this way, America? And a Harvard economist. But they couldn't even like talk about it in public. They had to truly, this is true. It doesn't sound true. They dressed up as duck hunters, snuck off on a private rail car to a closed private resort. And there, they secretly cooked up a plan for the Fed. And
wow.
Even so, they were so wary that people would freak out about a central bank that they were like, okay, let's make a bunch of little central banks, right? And so this is why we have this network of Federal Reserve banks that are now sort of anachronistic, frankly. There's one in New York. I don't know if there's one.
There's one right down the street from us.
There is. Okay. Yeah. They're scattered. There's one in Minneapolis. There's one in San Francisco. Wow. That is the legacy of this argument over centralized power, this fear that a central bank would be too much concentration of power.
But nonetheless, we've got this powerful Federal Reserve. I'm thinking, you know, just a couple of months ago, pouring trillions of dollars into our economy. Congress, obviously, as well, pouring trillions of dollars because of this pandemic economy. But using that as an example, is that how it's supposed to work, which is to save us from real serious
yes.
Great Depression?
Yes, yes. I mean, so the Fed became much more centralized after the Great Depression, and the Fed, you know, notoriously in the Great Depression kind of underreacted and failed to save the country, which is its fundamental job, even arguably caused the Depression, made things much worse. And I think to a significant extent learned that lesson well. And what happened this spring when the crisis hit was really extraordinary. I mean, the amount the Federal Reserve did and how fast it did it was historic. You know, lending not only to the financial system as it traditionally has, but also to ordinary businesses, to cities and states. It truly has gone farther than it ever has before. And I think it's done a pretty good job. I mean, we haven't heard that much about it, but I think in part because it hasn't been that controversial, right? So like what you hear about is the things that people are angry about. And not that many people are angry about what the Fed is doing. I think it's basically done the right thing.
Let me just make sure that everyone knows I'm talking with Jacob Goldstein. He's the co-host of Planet Money. You can hear Planet Money noon at WHYY on Saturdays. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing. I do want to pick up on this pandemic economy. For lack of a better word, I think we all know what we're talking about. The fact that, you know, millions of people have lost their jobs. The Federal Reserve and the U.S. government pouring trillions of dollars into the economy. I'd just be curious about your take about what the government and the Federal Reserve have done of late.
I mean, so to go back to, you know, March, April, when the crisis hit, it was remarkable. So we talked about the Fed.
Yeah.
It was also remarkable how fast Congress acted. I mean, maybe even more remarkable, right, given our expectations that Congress doesn't often act in a rapid and dramatic fashion, right? And indeed, they acted in a very rapid and very dramatic fashion, passed a bill that put trillions of dollars into the economy, and in fact, worked quite well by almost all accounts. You know, obviously there were many controversies and lots of problems, but I think the most important part of it was this expanded unemployment, right? Millions and millions of people lost their jobs, and this bill that the Congress passed in the spring gave people an extra $600 a week on top of regular unemployment, which is a lot, right? Which
is
good. And you saw this extraordinary thing, which was at this moment in like May or so, as the unemployment rate was going through the roof, you actually saw income and savings for ordinary people going up. And that was entirely the result of Congress acting. Like, that was putting money in people's pockets. Now, I would argue, unfortunately, that has run out. There was a sort of temporary kind of halfway measure that is also running out. And just today, there was another sort of half-baked thing that didn't get through Congress. So I would say Congress's initial reaction was quite robust and quite competent. They have not followed it up, and they're, you know, the unemployment rate is still very high, and so now it's a problem.
And it's so concerning that for so many people, getting money through unemployment was more than what they were getting paid for doing actual work.
Yes, I mean, initially, you know, so the typical recipient, you know, unemployment varies from state to state, but the $600 a week plus, it was typically about $1,000 a week, which is like, right, you know, $50,000 a year. That is like a reasonable amount of money.
Yeah.
People were initially afraid that that would disincentivize people from going back to work, which theoretically seems plausible. But when they looked at the data, that didn't seem to happen. You know, people, if they could get a job, would take one. It was more stable. People wanted to go back to work. So It was a good program. I mean, the main problem is that it has run out sort of too soon. The unemployment rate is still very high.
It seems, though, that our economy, as it stands now, and I talked about billionaires in my introduction, has revealed incredible inequities in our country, frankly. The fact that you've got so many billionaires with so much money, and you've got so many people in the middle who are struggling, and then, of course, those at the bottom who are barely, you know, keeping their head above water. Looking back at you know, other sort of golden ages and times of great wealth, are there lessons you think for today?
That's an interesting question. I mean, one thing I've been thinking about, and this is not in the book, I don't know as much about it, but a project I've been interested in is the Progressive Era, right? If you go back, the Gilded Age was the end of the 19th century. And in a lot of ways, it parallels the time we've been living through. There were these technological advances, you know, it was like electricity was big, right, which was a big deal at the time, the internal combustion engine. So you had these new fortunes and you had financiers like today, right? You had J.P. Morgan, who was, you know, instead of the hedge fund managers. And you had this very large concentration of wealth. And then in the early part of the 20th century, you had this reaction, which was basically the progressive movement, the, you know, original progressive movement. And so I have wondered, is that a model for today? And as I said, I haven't really studied that, but it does seem like, you know, you have technological change, and then you have like rising wealth and rising inequality, and then you have a sort of democratically led backlash. Yeah, it was a backlash. And you had, you know, I believe the minimum wage came out of that. I know you had the first real antitrust enforcement, right? Teddy Roosevelt going after Standard Oil. And that's another thing people are talking about today is, you know, antitrust laws and the big tech companies. So that to me is the interesting historical model for the present.
Yeah, I mean, we're at a really interesting juncture in our history. You have described, and others have described, this recovery that we're in as looking like the letter K.
Yeah. So,
we know what the letter K looks like. What does that mean?
So when everything collapsed in the spring, right, you can think of, you know, think of a chart that's just like whatever, the economy. And it goes down really sharply in the spring, right? And the question people were asking at that time was, are we going to have a V-shaped recovery? And the V is just, it goes down really sharply, right, and then it goes up really sharply, right? And that was what we were hoping for. It's like, oh, well, it went down really fast. Let's hope it goes back up really fast. But you have to kind of close your eyes and imagine this. What we found instead is this sort of bifurcated recovery. So imagine, you know, it goes down and then it starts going up for the people who are well off. The stock market went back up a lot. People who, you know, have white collar jobs and can work from home are doing well. So that part of the line is going up. And then there's another line. This is the K now, the kind of leg on the K that is still going down, right? And that is for people who, you know, have service jobs, have jobs they cannot do from home, who are unemployed, and now the expanded unemployment has run out. So it's basically a way of describing this bifurcation, where for one group of people who are okay, who have stock, who have their jobs, things are going pretty well. For another group of people who do not have those things, things are going quite badly.
And it's interesting to think about how we value money. We treat money that people make on the stock market differently than how we treat money that people make in terms of their wages.
We do. We tax it at a different rate, which is quite regressive, frankly, because the vast majority of stock market gains go to people at the very high end of the wealth distribution. And the tax rate on capital gains is lower than the tax rate on income. Although I should say not for people who are low income. Low income people actually pay quite low tax rates. But if you make like, if you're like middle class, upper middle class, you pay more on income than you pay on capital gains.
It's interesting to think about the future of money, especially during a pandemic when so many people are home. Many people are shopping online. I mean, one worries, of course, about the kind of mom and pops on the main street. But at the same time, there's less current. I brought a $10 bill, but there's less actual currency being exchanged. It's more online.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go in that little windowless room where the right. ATM is to get money, right? I will definitely pay with my phone.
I'm
or
kind
my
of
credit
old-fashioned
card if I
that
can.
Way. I don't know. I like cash. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I have some, you know, in the go bag in the hallway for, you know, if everything really goes south.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So there are these two different things going on, right? It feels like we don't need cash anymore. And indeed, people report using less cash day to day, even before the pandemic, right? And stores, you know, there are some stores that don't take cash. Didn't Philly pass some law requiring stores to take cash?
To take cash, because many people in this city are unbanked. I mean, they don't have bank accounts. So they live on a cash economy. Yes.
Yes. That's obviously a problem. And frankly, people without bank accounts, like, that is a problem whether or not we have cash, right? People who don't have bank accounts are getting screwed. They have the risk of carrying cash. They have to go to the check cashing store. So, like, that's a problem whatever happens with cash. So I will say, though, to return to this idea of, you know, it feels like cash is disappearing, there is this weird countervailing fact, and that is there is more cash, more paper money in the world than ever. The amount of paper money in the world has been increasing. And in fact, it started increasing even faster when the pandemic hit. And so this is kind of a puzzle, right? I mean, some of it is. So the U.S. dollar is the global reserve currency. It's the most sound money in the world. And so lots of people outside the U.S. use dollars. If you live in a country where the banks are unstable, where the currency is unstable, you know, lots of people just hold dollars as a way to store wealth, as a way to keep their life savings. But also lots of people hold paper money because it's great for committing crimes, right? Especially hundreds. And there are more hundreds than ones, right? There are like $4,000 in hundreds for every man, woman, and child in America. So this is clearly not just like whatever, giving, you know, your grandson a $100 bill for his birthday. This is clearly like crime. And so there is actually an interesting argument, not that cash is going to go away on its own, but that maybe we should get rid of hundreds because you don't really need them to live your honest life. And clearly they're really helpful for criminals.
I never thought of that. And we're talking about what, money laundering or, you know, buying a house for cash because you have to take your drug money and bury it somewhere?
Yeah, money laundering. And in fact, one of the interesting things that happened this spring when the pandemic hit in Los Angeles, there were all these wholesale stores that drug dealers used to launder money, basically. They used it to move money overseas. There was this whole web with China and the U.S. and Mexico. It's like, you know, multinational corporations moving drugs and money around the world. And part of their whole financial system was they would sell drugs for cash, and then they would use these stores to launder their cash, basically, to get it back overseas and be able to spend it. But what, all the stores closed, right? California closed all of its businesses. And so these drug dealers were stuck with this amazing problem of piles of $100 bills. And so federal agents actually started just seizing millions and millions of dollars from the drug dealers this spring because they couldn't launder their money just because their stores shut down. So it's a real thing.
More about money with Planet Money's Jacob Goldstein after this very short break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mark.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Mas Coena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. My guest is Jacob Goldstein, co-host of NPR's Planet Money that airs Saturday at noon on WHYY, also the author of a new book, Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. This interview was a special WHYY audience event. Let me get some more questions from our audience. Elizabeth asks, is it true that Catherine the Great spent her treasury on wars and amassing the art that's now in the Hermitage, so she just printed money to boost the confidence of the people? If so, it means that in the 19th century it was backed by nothing, kind of a Russian emperor's new clothes. True? Not true?
I don't know. I mean, I will say, the classic thing for governments to spend money on, especially before the 20th century, before there were welfare states, was war. And wars were the one time when, even when gold and silver were money, governments would print paper and basically say, we'll get you back after the war. You know, in the U.S., you saw it in the Civil War. That was the government printed what were called greenbacks, this green paper money. You saw it in the Revolutionary War when the revolutionaries, the founding fathers, printed paper money called continentals, and they actually printed so much it became worthless. Apparently, there used to be an expression, not worth a continental. That's what people say in books about money, but I never heard that expression, so I didn't put it in the book.
Let me read another comment. Tom asks, why hasn't inflation gone up much despite the Fed pouring trillions of dollars into the economy? Has the stimulus only been a small percentage of the total money out there? Does that matter?
I love this question.
Yeah.
This is a similar question that people asked in the years after the 2008 financial crisis, right? At that time, you know, 2009, 2010, the recovery was very slow, unemployment was very high. And so the Fed started printing trillions of dollars, just creating trillions of dollars out of thin air. And it was a huge increase in how much money the Fed has created. And lots of people said, we're going to have inflation. Credible people said, this is going to create massive inflation. And it didn't happen. Mm. Indeed, inflation was sort of bizarrely low for years and years and years. The kind of monetary story of the last 10 years was, why is inflation so low? The Fed came out a number of years ago and said, we're officially going to have this target, 2% inflation. And year after year, inflation was below 2%. And so there are various theories as to why inflation has been so low. But I think the basic idea is, inflation is partly a function of money, but it's really a function of sort of how much stuff people want to buy and how much stuff is getting produced, right? And so the Fed creates money, but unless it's sort of really getting out there to everybody and everybody's going out and buying stuff, it's not going to create inflation. That's the bottom line. So again, the Fed has created all this money, and arguably that has prevented a collapse. But it wouldn't be inflationary unless suddenly everybody was making more money and going out to buy stuff. That's the inflationary part.
I'm thinking about all that money that the Fed and other and the government has been spending of late. I'm assuming it's, I'm not sure what our national debt is now, but I'm sure it's up there. Who owns our debt? And is, what does that tell us about money?
Oh, those are good. Those are good. Fun questions. Okay, so the debt is largely owned domestically. There are a lot of people all around the world who hold it, though. I mean, China holds a lot of U.S. debt. One of the interesting things about U.S. debt in particular is it is basically the safest investment in the world, which is great for America, right? Because it means when there's a crisis, that's a time both when the government needs to borrow, and it's also a time when people around the world are desperate to lend to the U.S. government, right? They're like, please take our money for safekeeping. So the government has been borrowing all this money, but it has been borrowing at extraordinarily low interest rates. It can borrow for 10 years for, like, I don't know, 1%-ish.
Right.
Which is good for America. Like, it's good for the government to be borrowing money right now, as long as they're spending it on anything somewhat reasonable. Borrowing money and giving it to people who are out of work keeps the economy going in a way that will be, you know, it's not only humane, it will be profitable for the U.S. in the long run.
Here's a question from Eileen. She says, for me to explain it to others, how would you explain the idea that the stock market does not actually reflect the economy? And it does feel as, you know, we get these really terrible, worrisome job numbers one day, and then we see the stock market go up almost in response. I'm not sure if it's in response or not, but help us understand that disconnect between these.
Yes,
these two
I like
entities.
The prompt so I can explain it to others. That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
let me see. You can tell me how you do explaining it to others. So, a couple of things, right? So, I mean, one, on a simple level, the ownership of stock is very, very concentrated among really rich people in this country, right? So, like, most of the stock market is owned by a small number of people. Like, lots of people own a little, right? If you have a retirement account, you probably own some stock. But when the stock market goes up, it doesn't do much for most people. So that's one level of why the stock market is not the economy.
Right.
Another is this: what the value of the stock market really is, to the extent that it's meaningful, the extent that it's rational, which is debatable, is people's long-term expectations of corporate profits, basically, right? When you buy a share of stock, what you're fundamentally buying is a share of the profits of the company from now until forever.
Right.
And so to the extent it's rational, it's a very long-term view, right? It's not based on today. And, you know, what's going on in the economy today is much better reflected by, say, unemployment or wages.
Speaking about sort of money and debt, I remember in the recession of 2008 learning about the LIBOR rate. I mean, talk about a nerdy thing to know.
You went deep.
We went deep. Yes, yeah. Exactly. But it was what you got charged, I think, overnight for borrowing money. I mean, how much of just money is about borrowing money?
Oh, a lot. A lot. I mean, you know, if you think of a bank deposit, right? Think about banks. Most money is banks, right? When we think of money, we think of a dollar bill, right? Because it's visual. But really, when we think about money, we should think of a bank deposit. Whatever. Close your eyes and think of like when you log into Chase on your computer and see the number there next to how much you have in your checking account. That's what most money is. And what that is actually a loan you are making to the bank. It doesn't feel that way, but your bank deposit is a loan that you're making to the bank. And what the bank is doing is turning around and lending money to other people, right? And when banks lend money to other people, they're actually creating new money. They don't have like a pile of dollar bills for every dollar bill in everybody's bank account. It's all made up. And it's almost all debt going one way or another through banks.
Here's Kathy asks, or says, Cuba is now using dollars because they can take it to other countries to purchase goods. Interesting comment.
Yeah, I mean, the extent to which the dollar is a global currency is really extraordinary. You know, I mean, Cuba is a special case in some regards, but it's true basically everywhere. You know, if somebody in whatever, Brazil wants to buy some, you know, goods, you have a clothing shop in Rio and you want to buy some shirts from a factory in Vietnam, right? You're not going to send them reals or Vietnamese dong. You are going to pay in dollars. Right. You're going to buy in dollars. The Vietnamese merchant is going to want dollars. The dollar truly is this global currency. Yeah. As I said, that's part of the reason people want to borrow it. It's also the case. I mean, one interesting, very overlooked thing that happened just this year in the crisis was the Fed started lending dollars to central banks all around the world because there are these dollar economies in other countries, right? That business in Brazil, say, that's, you know, needs dollars to buy shirts, might borrow dollars in Brazil, right? And so when there's a financial crisis, everybody around the world is suddenly clamoring for dollars. And the only place on the planet that can print dollars out of thin air is the Federal Reserve. So it really is an extraordinary global power that the U.S. has, that the dollar is the reserve currency.
And can we think that that will go on forever?
I mean, not forever. Nothing lasts forever. Well, so, you know, I've been at Planet Money for 10 years. And when I started, we were like, well, what's next, right? I mean, the euro seemed pretty good. Like, oh, Europe, they got their act together. And then there was the euro crisis. And so the euro seems like not so great now relative to the dollar. I mean, China is an obvious rising economic power. But China has much more control over their currency. They limit how much money can go into the country and come out of the country. And if you want to be the global reserve currency, you need to be more hands-off than that, right? You need your money to be flowing all over the world. And so unless China is willing to be much more hands-off with its currency, I don't think the yuan is going to take over. So it doesn't seem imminent that the dollar is going to go anywhere.
Tom asks, should we be just as concerned about financial surveillance as we are about other types of surveillance? Is financial surveillance as old as money or a more recent innovation?
I think financial surveillance in many ways is more recent. In a world where coins or paper are money, it's much harder to track, right? And that is, you know, to our point about cash and especially $100 bills being really useful for committing crimes, it's because cash is this very anonymous technology, right? It's amazing that, like, I could just walk up to you and give you a $100 bill and you'll give me all this stuff and nobody has to know, right? Like, it's incredible. Right. And so the shift to buying stuff online, buying stuff with credit cards is very much a shift into the surveillance world. And in fact, the sort of prehistory of Bitcoin starts in the 1980s with this brilliant UC Berkeley cryptographer who saw this coming and set out to figure out a way you could have electronic money that could not be surveilled. And people spent sort of 20 years trying to solve a series of really interesting technical problems before they finally came up with Bitcoin, which itself is not entirely anonymous. It's pseudonymous, but it's a little bit trackable.
Can we imagine a world without money? Is that, I mean, we'd have to, I guess, roll back the clock in certain ways, but is there something that's not money that's in our future?
Well, I hope not, I would say. I mean, you know, I could think of a few ways the world could work without money. You know, one would be we can imagine the sort of pre-industrial, you know, small self-sufficient societies where everything is reciprocal. And like, that does have a nice ring to it, although I'm probably idealizing it a lot. But in any case, like, I'm not going to get there from here, right? They definitely don't need a podcaster or an author in that world. So I'm not a good farmer. So that's kind of off the table. You could go to the other end of the spectrum if you're thinking, how could we live without money? You could say, okay, you could have a really basically authoritarian society, right? You could have a big complicated society where the government takes everything everybody makes and then decides who gets what, right? There's no buying in this world. You just take whatever the government gives you. And I also don't want to live in that world. Yeah. And so, you know, I do feel like for all the problems it causes, money is better than the alternative.
I'd like to ask you just a couple of personal questions,
because,
you know, it's always nice to know a little
bit
about somebody. But how did you get interested in money? And I have to say, in my personal life, I don't like talking about, I don't like thinking about money. It's just, it's not something I'm comfortable with.
Tell me why, if I might ask.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of it is being an entitled person, which I clearly am. And having grown up, you know, in very comfortable circumstances. And so, but also believing because of the way my family ran our family, thinking we didn't have any money because my mother never turned the heat on and there was nothing left to eat and all. So I have this very strange...
That might make you think about money, right? It could go either way.
Exactly. No, I'm probably revealing more than my family wants me to do, but sort of on the one hand having money, but also on the other hand feeling like we don't have any money because all I'm wearing is my sister's hand-me-down clothes.
Yes. See, this is interesting, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, what about for you, Jay?
You know, I mean, we both work in public radio, right? So clearly, I feel like that suggests neither of us set out to get a lot of money. Right. But I do think it's possible to think about money even if you're not, like, seeking a lot of money, right? I mean, even the dynamics you were talking about seem really sort of complicated and interesting. Like, I really like saving money. I really like figuring out how to get a deal, right? I mean, sort of professionally, intellectually, it was like the financial crisis and Planet Money were when I got interested in it more on a theoretical level. You know, I went and started working at Planet Money in 2010 and the financial crisis was over and, you know, the show had come into being really to explain the financial crisis. And so we were sort of like, well, what other kind of big idea things can we talk about? And, you know, the Fed was creating trillions of dollars out of thin air at this point. And we started doing really basic, like, what is money type of shows.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like we did a episode of This American Life and Ira Glass called What is Money the most stoner question ever posed on the show, which I take as a badge of honor.
Absolutely.
But like there are good stoner questions, right? You wake up the next day and a lot of the time you're like, well, that was just ridiculous. But sometimes you're like, that was an interesting question. I'm going to keep looking into it. And it persisted in being interesting to me because it leads to all these historical stories. It leads to all of these interesting social forces, at least all these interesting ideas all around this really powerful idea of money.
Who manages money in your house? Or is it a democracy or autocracy?
I mean, I pay the bills.
Okay.
I pay the bills. I try and be like chill about it. I'm definitely the more cheap half of the couple, but you know, it's useful to learn to be less cheap. It's useful to just learn to enjoy a restaurant meal. Maybe order the dessert. Why not? Go crazy.
Right. Not look at the prices first and then go, you know,
I'm never going to not look at the prices
first.
I don't know what
enough
to tell you. Sorry.
But it feels like there's sort of like a civic education that we need, an education in financial literacy, just because, as we've been talking for an hour, I mean, we deal with money every day. And yet I think for some people, as like myself, are sort of uncomfortable with it. And other people, of course, it's a struggle. And we need to, I think, have a better feel for what money is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I hope the book helps a little, but it's a big problem.
That was Jacob Goldstein, co-host of Planet Money, author of a new book titled, you guessed it, Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing. This was a special WHYY audience event. Thanks to Christine Holbert. Also thanks to our engineering and technical staff, Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hirschfeld, Diana Martinez, Mike Villers, Shenga Tab, and Charlie Kyer. The event was produced by Radio Times' Debbie Builder and the interview edited by Radio Times' John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. You can download a podcast of this and other Radio Times interviews wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen.